All right, thank you, Clay. And once again, we have no liners. When are we going to fix this problem? Is this like a plot?
They're trying to get us off the air. And
you think so? Are we that persecuted? Are we the folks that are delivering the scientific truth such that people want us off the air?
Yeah.
All right, well, we have no theme music, and again, I'm not going to sing it like I did a couple weeks ago, but I am going to remind people that the opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not necessarily reflect those of WREK Atlanta or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Now that we have plausible deniability, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ledovitz, and I am joined by the honeybee whisperer, Jennifer Kraft-Levy. We've decided that's her title. You could live with that one, right?
Yeah.
I like. Is that like nice. Cool? Is that like a good start of bar stories? And
oh, yeah. As you mentioned bees and in a bar, and, you know,
really?
There's no shortage of conversation.
I had no idea bees in a bar. Started conversation like that. Unfortunately, one of our student posse, Gwen, is out today. We've got Clay Sublett in here running the big board. Okay. Do we know where Daniel is? Is Daniel like, oh, I've got too many midterms?
Probably. I don't know. We don't need him.
You're
don't
not
tell him I said
Daniel's
that.
Keeper. All right. Yeah. Daniel, utterly superfluous. Hopefully, we'll be showing up a little bit later. And the title of today's program is The Robot in You. Sounds like a science fiction film. New from Touchstone Pictures this fall. It's The Robot in You. My guest, Craig Forrest, is looking at me like, was Pete drinking before we started this thing?
Hello.
No, in fact not. So Craig Forrest, our guest, has actually been on the show several times because Craig Forrest is the co-founder of the Inventure Prize competition, and you've appeared with a number of the finalists here over the years, right?
That's right. Yeah, the Inventure Prize is the largest undergraduate invention competition in the United States. About 600 students last year competed in this American Idol for Nerds competition.
And speaking of American Idol for Nerds, you yourself have been part of American Idol for Nerds in a sense, right? Because did you not win the New York competition for American, is it American Inventor or American Inventors?
It was American Inventor, a very short-lived reality show on ABC.
Okay, and then you went to the LA show. What happened in LA?
We got beaten by a fireman.
I mean, literally pummeled by a fireman. He's like, that's it. I pity you. I pity the fool that no.
So in this TV show, the six finalists competed for $1 million grand prize for the summer in Los Angeles. And they'd chosen, you know, the six finalists according to some very specific criteria. You had the single working mom. Mm-hmm. You had the tea leaf reading new age couple.
You oh, so they're going for diversity.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
You had the good school teacher, and then
you were the Harvard and MIT nerds.
That's right. We were the born with a silver spoon, Ivy League nerds. And then of course there was the fireman and his invention, which actually won him $1 million, was an angel that sits on top of your Christmas tree. And when your Christmas tree catches on fire, the angel pees all over it.
Okay,
it's
a sprinkling angel.
It sounds practical.
Yeah,
it also sounds
all about saving the kids.
Where does the water come from?
Is it inside the angel?
That's a great question. You know, practical engineers would ask these kinds of questions. And what they envisioned was a tank of water as a wrapped up like a present under the tree that was pressurized with carbon dioxide.
Nothing can go wrong with that.
It kind of sounds like he just wants to save himself some work in the future.
Right.
Okay, but what about religious diversity here? What if I don't want an angel? What if I want a star on my tree?
I think they're coming out with the Jewish line this year.
Okay, yeah. So
Jews
if I want
to have trees.
Well, they have Hanukkah bushes.
No.
Do Hanukkah bushes catch on fire?
There's no such thing as a Hanukkah bush.
Then why have I heard this from Jewish comedians? Did they just make this up for the sake of the joke? So I have a lot of friends of different faiths, and I...
You could use a sprinkler for your menorah, because the menorahs sometimes can get a little tippy. They can get a little tippy.
Catch the drapes on fire, things like that. So, but actually, I watched the video of your New York Finals thing.
What was your invention? Wait.
Tell us about your invention.
It's a quirky gadget.
I thought it was very good, though.
It's a storage rack for your bicycle.
And the name?
The Claw.
It's called The Claw.
I love The Claw.
And the idea is if you want to store your bike up out of the way, which about 40% of cyclists do, 40 million cyclists out of the 100 million in this country prefer to hang their bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And the claw makes it very easy to just lift your bike up and the claw grabs it.
Yeah, you push it up and then the claw slams shut around it.
That's right. It's very like a claw grabs the wheel.
But I will say this.
You hang it from the ceiling?
Yeah. The ceiling or the wall.
Mm-hmm. I hang other things from the ceiling and the wall other than bicycles. I hang ladders and other things.
Yeah, yeah.
And ladders are tough because you have to put one in and then the other end in, and putting them over those J-shaped hooks is actually very difficult.
It's a pain.
Yeah, it is. I love your invention.
Thanks.
So did George Foreman, by the way. George Foreman was one of the judges in the New York City
Fight. That's correct.
He loved it. He was all excited about this.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not since the Foreman grill have we seen.
Did it clamp shut on its own?
Yeah, claps out of its own. Yeah.
And then if you pushed it up, it would open so you could pull it down, right?
You can buy yours today in Sears, Lowe's, or Amazon.
Is it really?
Yeah.
For real?
Yeah.
So even though you lost the competition, you won in the end. You used your white privilege to...
That's right.
...find an investor.
And you're making billions off this now?
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Okay. I mean, this reminds me of all the book chapters I write where I get a check once a year for, you know, $37.50.
That's right.
You know, because seven people bought it that year. All right. So aside from that, your research group, okay, let me see if I get this right, makes tools that can measure characteristics of individual cells and substances in the human body. And you're applying this to a number of diseases, specifically diseases of the brain. And do you use the same innovation, you know, drive that you use to invent the claw, you do in your regular research?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the culture of invention in the lab, I think, is very similar. It's, I mean, the brain is the ultimate frontier in the human body. You know, if you have a broken leg or a bad organ, you know, that stuff can be fixed, you know, generally speaking. But there's no cure for any diseases of the brain. If you've got Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or epilepsy, even a headache. I mean, what's the cure for a headache? You can bathe your entire body in aspirin, or you can, you know, hit yourself on the head with a frying pan. I mean,
do doctors recommend that, hitting yourself?
It's one of the lesser known
treatments.
It's
the roadrunner version of therapy.
So the problem, the reason why we don't have any cures for any of these things is that we do not understand how the brain works. Okay, we don't know where memories are stored. We don't know what goes wrong with diseases. We don't know. We've never even measured as something as simple as two neurons talking to each other in the living brain with a fine resolution.
And that is a lot of what your research does, right? So we've done tests in vitro, outside the body, and we can observe these things. But I think more and more we're realizing that in the network of the brain, it's actually quite different.
Yeah, it's really weird. Most people think that the neurons function, the neuron is the technical name for a brain cell, that the identity, the very identity of the cell and its job is determined by who it's connected to. And when you take those out of the brain to study them in a petri dish, you sever a lot of those connections and thereby change its identity. And so there's a big effort underway nationally to try to understand neuron function and measure the activity of these cells while they are still in the brain of a living organism.
Mm-hmm. So before we get to the details of how you and your research group do that, let me remind you that you actually take a lot of this innovation stuff and you apply it here at Georgia Tech, right? So I mentioned before you're the founder of the Inventure Prize competition, still heavily involved in that. And this semester, correct, you are doing the idea to prototype portion of the CreateX program here at Georgia Tech?
Oh, yeah. Now, this is cool. Okay, so for most students at Georgia Tech, they come here and for 5 years or 4 years or whatever, 8 years in some cases, they take classes where they are told what they need to know, and then they go into an exam and they regurgitate that information.
I call it the shampoo model.
Okay, right.
Your shampoo says lather, rinse, repeat. It's memorize, regurgitate, repeat.
Right. And so we are trying to encourage a culture here at Georgia Tech, you know, one of the largest engineering schools in the country, which is instead based on students pursuing their own ideas. Students come in here and they want to change the world. They want to learn engineering skills or science skills or whatever, so they can make an impact on people's lives and pursue their own ideas. And mm-hmm. So instead of stamping that out and saying, okay, first learn all this stuff and then you can go do that, we're saying we want to encourage that from day one. We want to ask students, what are you interested in working on? What grand challenges or what problems really excite you? Is it a hobby? Whatever it is, like the claw for me, I was a cyclist. I wanted to come up mm-hmm. with a little gadget, whatever, okay? And we will encourage you to do that. And so this program specifically that you mentioned, Idea to Prototype, is quite simple. If you have an idea, Georgia Tech will give you course credit and money to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the currency of the university. What more can we give you than course credit and money?
All right, I'm looking to the student posse. Those are the two biggies. If you threw in pizza, that would be the okay. trifecta, correct?
Right.
Usually those are exclusive because for research you either get paid yes. or credit.
Well, they don't give you money to spend on pizza. They actually give you money to use to build your prototype, correct?
Right. That's not right. money for your pocket.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, that's right. Of course. That's right.
Wow.
So already we have about 10 teams of students working on this, 10 teams, mm-hmm. and we're really hoping to take it up the next level next semester. And so students will give this a try. I mean, this is the time. They're young. They have ideas, and they don't have to pay a mortgage or take care of a dog too often, so they can mm-hmm. really just soak in the idea and try to make it happen.
So what fraction of the students that are in the course this semester you think will build an idea that will eventually go on to be something big? And what fraction will just fail miserably and realize they have to do it differently?
Well, you know, invention's really hard. Most people fail miserably. And so...
I would agree.
And so, you know, sometimes just having the opportunity to pursue your own ideas changes your mindset on the world. So let's say you do end up going to work for a John Deere or a Google where you're working on other people's ideas and trying to improve that company's outlook. That mindset of having the confidence, the entrepreneurial confidence to pursue your own ideas will benefit you there.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, in my GT1000 freshman seminar class, we had the guys come in from General Mills who talked about intrapreneurship, right? Gluten-free Cheerios didn't get developed on its own. They actually uh-huh. talked about that as an example. And this will help you if you work for a company, if you leave that company, start your own company. It doesn't really matter. The idea of that innovation and creation, I think, is good. And I think if every single one of them fails, the learning experience is no less significant.
Right.
I will say this, though, that... and maybe Jennifer has a viewpoint on this as well, coming from biology. So mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, right? You guys are big on making prototypes, right? Because you can take, you know, a National Instruments board and you can create something. Or if you're a computer science person, you can take a device, a computer, make the app, make the program, make the software. Mechanical engineering, you can use a 3D printer, make the prototype of things, right? Mm. You have this great shop, the Invention Studio, which my Startup House folks toured last week. They were very, very impressed.
Awesome.
And this is something that you basically started here as well. Run by students and run well. I know we don't say that a lot in front of you guys. We're like, we can't let students run this thing. They'll mess it up. Actually, I've heard that the administration is trying to get a hold of that. I think we want to keep it in the hands of the students.
Just like WREK.
Just like WMA.
Run well by students.
So I think they're doing a really great job. But majors like mine, chemical engineering, we struggle with the prototype. Because now the way you do a business is you no longer pitch a big business plan with a lot of made-up numbers. You walk in with a prototype and a very simple business canvas description of this thing, and boom, you start it yourself.
Mm.
Right? You get this minimal viable product. We struggle with chemical engineers, and that's why there are only three chemical engineers involved in your thing, which I'm trying to encourage more of them.
Well, 3 out of 38 is not bad.
Actually, that's not too bad. That's not too bad.
You know, anybody can invent stuff. I mean, at the Capstone Expo last year, we had a team of international affairs majors presenting an invention, which was a policy for the legalization of marijuana.
And they gave out brownies.
They did give out brownies, and that, they scored very well in the competition.
They were
reason.
Quite good. I saw them. And the brownies were excellent. I believe they were regular brownies, but nonetheless... the irony was actually pretty good. So that's amazing. I think that's great that our students have those opportunities. And speaking of unique opportunities, our Science in the News today, do we have the thing from Science in the News? That's okay. We won't use it. We'll get our liners back next week, I'm sure, when we get in a new system. Comes from this week's Science Magazine Online by Tania Rabasandratana.
Nice accent.
Okay, thank you. Entitled, The European Union Helps Match Refugees with Science Jobs. There it is. Finally, someone who is not criticizing refugees. I think we forget that unlike Donald Trump's viewpoint, a lot of refugees are people that have amazing skills, amazing work ethics, and talents. And some of those are in the science and technology fields. Since the beginning of the year, more than 500,000 refugees fleeing civil war and unrest in the Middle East and elsewhere have sought safety in the European Union. Yesterday, the European Commission said it will do its bit to help the scientists among them find research jobs under a program called Science for Refugees, launched today by the EU Research Commissioner, Carlos Modas. The commission says it will help match refugees with universities willing to hire them. Refugees and asylum seekers with a science background can upload their resume on dedicated pages on Euraxis, the EU research careers website. Meanwhile, universities willing to help them get a badge from the commission as refugee welcoming organizations and advertise jobs, internships, and training programs as refugee friendly. Several universities have already said they will sign up, including the University of Strasbourg in France and the University of Leuven in Belgium. The United Kingdom, the Council for At-Risk Academics, which, believe it or not, in the 1930s helped scientists escape the Nazi threat and continue their career abroad, is now helping persecuted scientists from Syria. Uh-oh. In particular. What?
I think your mic went out.
Did my mic go out?
No.
I heard it. Maybe your headphones are going out.
Maybe my headphones
are. This place is falling apart. But despite these limitations, ladies and gentlemen, we're delivering to you this important scientific information. I think that's cool. I've got a good friend from Iraq who we used to teach short courses in the Middle East. He's worked in the United States. He and his family are now in Jordan. We forget that a lot of really bright scientists and engineers are among these refugees that can really add to the STEM effort in a particular country. I mean, let's be honest. Most of the rocket program of the United States was imported from Germany.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So I just thought this was a great example of, you know, maybe refugees are a good thing. We always assume that refugees, I mean, if you believe certain presidential candidates, are not hardworking people. I'm sure there is a portion among them that is not. But I think most of them are. And it's particularly encouraging to have the opportunity to bring in STEM folks as well. I mean, don't we complain about that all the time? We don't have enough STEM people?
Totally agree.
So there it is.
The best grad student from my research laboratory in the past 6 years is an immigrant on a visa. And he just got a job being a professor at the University of Minnesota.
But if you think about it, this is a concept that is not foreign to us academics. Mm-hmm. Our environment is very diverse. We have students from all over the world. We have graduate students. We have faculty from all over the world because that is the community. If you want to be one of the best institutions in the world, you will take people from all over the place. So back to the brain. We actually had a caller calling with a question that I really don't know the answer to this. What exactly is a brain wave?
Ah, you know, I get this question.
Do you get this question a lot? Okay. What is a brainwave?
Okay, so as I mentioned, the brain is full of these tiny cells. The human brain has 86 billion neurons. So these cells are firing off, and they're not just firing randomly. They're firing occasionally in synchrony, playing somewhat of a concert, if you will. Mm-hmm. So there's the violin section, the drum section, and so on. And what's referred to as a brain wave is sort of one of the instruments of that orchestra playing. Mm-hmm. So if you record in the brain, you'll hear these rhythmic sounds that comes from a certain cells firing with a certain rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in a sense, it's like a regular wave. It's an oscillatory pattern.
Yeah, it's a periodic signal of electrical activity in the brain. And, for example, it can be modulated with consciousness or with anesthesia or with drugs or with disease. And so it tells us something about the state of that brain. So it's well known, for example, that if you, let's say you go in for a major surgery and you take anesthesia and you're unconscious, under certain anesthetics, like, say, ketamine, xylazine, you will potentially experience hallucinations while you are anesthetized. So you're unconscious, but you're having some hallucinations. When you wake up, you remember part of things or some dream or something you had. And that's because part of the brain is awake and part of the brain is anesthetized. That drug, for whatever reason, only acts on this part of the orchestra and not this other part. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so by measuring these brain waves during the surgery, you can tell, wow, that's weird. This part of the brain is awake. Why is that? So scientists are still trying to understand that, the effects of drugs on different types of brain cells in different parts of the brain.
So simply put, brain waves are the music the brain makes, and you can modify that with whole different approaches.
That's right. There's a brain radio station, but it's not that entertaining.
WBRAIN. Actually, we had Flavio Fenton from physics on a few weeks ago who talked about dynamic systems. And he looks at, you know, these oscillatory electronic signals in both the brain and the heart. Hmm. He believes that a lot of, fibrillation events are related to spiral waves, which is a particular kind of wave as opposed to, you know, your typical sort of cosine wave. And he actually thinks spiral waves are related to migraines in the brain. Hmm. Which underscores the point you make at the beginning. Not that I think about it, you're right. I know I have friends and family that suffer from migraines. We still struggle to understand this. And about the best we can do is put you in a dark room and give you a lot of painkillers and cross your fingers. It's not something that's treated well. So is it the complexity of the brain that makes it so difficult to understand?
Yeah, there's a language that we don't understand. Mm-hmm. You can record the firing of these cells, but what makes them fire and how do they fire under certain situations? We don't understand that language of communication. Mm-hmm. And there's so many of them. I mean, just like with the internet, you know, imagine if you were an alien from outer space and you saw these computers talking to each other and you had to figure out how a computer works just from looking at the internet. It would be very difficult, you know, mm-hmm. whether you're going backwards or forwards. It's incredibly complicated. So there's a huge national effort underway to be able to record this kind of brain activity in many cells at once. We hope that if you can record, again, back to the orchestra analogy, so if you could hear what each of these instruments is playing, you could sort of figure out, oh, I see, you know, these instruments only come on when this happens, or, you know, whenever these instruments play, these other ones play at the same time, and sort of try to figure out the physics of the situation. How is it working? And, you know, how does consciousness arise?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it sounds like what you're implying is that, you know, psychology and psychiatry are sort of the figuring out how computers work mm-hmm. by observing the internet. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to go one level lower. Oh, do we have a caller question?
We do have another question. They want to know about that number 85 billion or 86 billion neurons in the human brain. How is that known? Okay, so have you ever seen one of these games where you go into like the hotel lobby or whatever and there's a jar of jelly beans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, guess the number of jelly beans.
Right, and if you guess it, you get them. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's basically what happened. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. It's possible to measure the number of neurons in a small volume and then you can kind of multiply. It's like, how would you figure out how many people are at the Midtown Music Festival in Piedmont Park? You can take a picture and count the number of people in a small area and then multiply it out.
Right, and you could take a small jar, fill it up, calculate the density exactly. packing of jelly beans to make an estimate.
Exactly.
Are neurons, is the density of neurons relatively constant across the brain?
Yeah, for the most part. There are some structures in there. It's not just one homogenous blob of goo.
Blob of stuff.
Yeah. There are some structures, but yeah.
And is most of where you're concentrating in the higher brain, not, you know, down there on the amygdala and the lizard brain and things like that? Or
so one area that's really under a lot of study right now is the cortex. The cortex is like the skin, okay? It's like the surface of the brain. And as you may know, the human brain, if you look at it like sitting on the table in front of you, there's all these folds and surface mm-hmm. to it. So that's because the cortex, the skin of the brain, has so much surface area that it has to fold up on itself to sort of pack it all into your head. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that cortex is what really makes us human, people think. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's where these higher level things like decisions and recognizing like a tiger is coming for you and things like every signal, whether it's a motory signal or whether it's a sensory signal, it has to interact with the cortex to make a decision. Mm-hmm. For example, visual processing. You know, what we've been doing lately in my lab is recording in the brain while we show pictures to the subject, and then we can try to understand how the visual information is processed in the brain. So even something as simple as that, how does the brain see something and recognize it, is not well understood.
So how exactly do you do this? I mean, so if you can't pull things out and look at, you know, just a few of these things in a Petri dish, you've got to get in the brain with some kind of a tool.
Yeah.
And now it sounds invasive, like Dremel Moto tool drills into the brain and you're strapping electrodes to people and things like that.
Right.
Jennifer already looks nauseous here. She's kind of like, is it going to get more nauseating?
Okay, so...
And that's okay. You can go for it.
The cells in the brain are tiny. They're about 1/10 of the size of one of your hairs. Okay, so one of your hairs is about 100 micrometers in diameter, and a brain cell is about 1/10 of that, 10 micrometers in diameter.
Okay, so 1/1000th of a meter, micrometer. Right.
Yeah, 10/1000th of a meter. So you've got to get in there and measure the cells while they're firing. So yes, you have to go in. There's no imaging technique like MRI or CAT scanning or ultrasound that has that kind of resolution.
So you're right. I mean, functional MRI looks at areas of the brain. It looks at large clumps of cells.
So that can say,
whole organelle is lighting up.
Right.
You can see changes. But to see individual neurons sharing those electrical signals is really tough.
That's right. So if you want to know like what part of the brain lights up when you're feeling in love, then you can put someone in an MRI and see, oh, there's a lot more blood flow in the front of the brain when the person looks at this picture. Mm-hmm. And so that's the love part. Okay. Well, that's only so useful. You know, if you want to actually understand at the cellular level what's happening, you've got to go in and measure. And so what this involves is engineers and scientists have devised a number of ways to record in the brain at the cellular level. And for the most part, that involves placing tiny electrical wires into the brain. Very, very tiny electrical wires and tubes. Tubes which can attach to individual cells. And so this is what we do in my lab. We've built robotic tools that are able to lower these tubes or wires into the brain very, very precisely and attach them to individual cells without damaging them. Think about it like a single cell was the size of a water balloon. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've got this bag of water in front of me and I want to come in and record from it. So I've got this paper towel roll and I got to lower it until I just touch the surface of the balloon with the paper towel roll.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to attach that tube to that cell without bursting it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I attach it well, I can hear that cell in isolation from all of its neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
So as you go down with the tube, you hear this cacophony. It doesn't make any sense. But when you land on just one cell, you can hear its voice clear as day, separated from all the others. It's the most beautiful
thing. What is the voice of a cell sound like?
Help me.
So it's like the Who's down in Whoville. But when you say voice, what you're doing is you're isolating probably an oscillating electrical signal.
Exactly.
Okay.
The cell is firing electrical signals. That's how cells talk.
Okay.
And this wasn't discovered that long ago. It was about 30 years ago with the use of a very cool method called patch clamping that won the Nobel Prize. Patch clamping was the tool that allowed us to discover that neurons talk to each other through electrical fluctuations.
Right.
And so we're able to record from a cell, and then we can deliver some stimulus. Like we can say now, let's say we give some drugs, or let's say we show them a picture on a TV screen.
Mm-hmm.
How does that cell change? And start to understand, it's linked in some way to this activity or this behavior or this drug. And so we can model that. We can try to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So patch clamping is just like attaching a voltage meter, right?
Pretty much. It's just like in your house, if you have an electrical outlet and you put a multimeter in the socket and it tells you it's 120 volts, and then maybe you turn on a lamp and the voltage goes down a little bit. This is like attaching a multimeter to a cell.
But that's got to be tough because I think of the analog, actually my wife's field in infertility, direct egg injection is something they do. And it's pretty easy to do because a human ovum is one of the biggest cells in the body. So you put it under a microscope, you literally take a micropipette, and we have guys that use micropipettes to sort of clamp onto cells as well in mechanical engineering.
Yeah.
And you inject it, and you can literally do it manually. But this sounds much more difficult. So how is it actually done?
Okay, so the tricky part of this technique is approaching a cell very delicately and resting the tip of your recording electrode against it. And that is detected based on the electrical resistance. So as you get closer and closer, as you can imagine, if back to this analogy with the balloon and the paper towel roll, when the balloon skin blocks the end of the paper towel roll, mm-hmm. the resistance can go up dramatically.
Right.
And so that's our sort of detection meter. Mm-hmm. And so what's, one of the things we're working with Garrett Stanley here on, that's been a big project in the lab over the past couple of years, is to be able to understand how, when you flick the whisker of a mouse, okay, so a mouse has whiskers, and it's kind of like our hands, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were to touch something, or the mouse touches something with its whisker, how does that signal propagate through the brain? Mm-hmm. How long does it take? How sensitive is it? So no one really understands how we sense things with our, how does our brain respond when we right. touch something?
Right.
And so we're able to sort of measure this, and this circuit, the electrical circuit that senses things, is not just one cell, it's a whole network,
right.
a whole right. circuit. And so by being able to record from multiple cells at the same time, while we touch things or flick the whisker, right. we can record the dynamics of the circuit in a resolution that's never been possible before.
Okay. So why do we care about modeling that circuit?
So imagine, for example, you want to restore a sense of touch to someone who doesn't have it. Mm-hmm. Let's say I wanted to have a prosthetic arm. Now, of course, a prosthetic arm or robotic arm would not have any nerve sensors in it. So if mm-hmm. you touch something with a table, you wouldn't feel it.
Right.
Well, let's say I wanted to stimulate the brain directly when someone touches the table with their prosthetic arm. Mm-hmm. So I could simulate that feeling
right.
so yeah. that your prosthetic arm would feel just like a normal arm.
So
I could have an implant in my brain while
I'm in the area where you think it works.
Exactly.
And it would output the right voltages at the right frequency exactly. in the right pattern.
Exactly.
And they would be linked to pressure sensors.
Exactly. How cool would that be?
Okay. That would be cool. That's See, I wasn't cool. even thinking that high. I was just thinking, you know, the macroscopic observation is that, you know, animals like mice, and I have a lot of dogs and cats, same thing, their whiskers sense a lot of stuff. It's actually a very important sensory organ for those animals. And just to understand the frequency at which that occurs, if something was at a higher frequency, maybe they couldn't sense it, or a lower frequency, the thing, you know, you could defeat my dog knowing where the dog food is or something. She always sticks her head in there and does things like that. But, wow, so you're actually trying to get to the model of sensation into the brain.
I mean, even to be able to say, this is how the brain mm-hmm. senses objects. It's these cells at this location and these voltages.
Right.
That would be a huge revolution in our understanding of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and couple that with people working on vision and drugs, the effects of drugs. I mean, now check this out. So there are lots of drug companies making drugs for the brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do they tell if those drugs are going to work? Well, of course, first they do lots of tests in test tubes and, you know, experiments in on a benchtop. But ultimately, they need to move to animal models.
Yeah. It's very guinea pigish.
That's right.
The way
so,
they do it.
So
yeah.
they got some animals and they...
Not
and
so
they,
many guinea pigs, probably.
I don't mean that literally.
You know, it's funny, the expression guinea pig, I was just reading about this. Guinea pigs were the first animal model used, but they've mm-hmm. fallen out of favor.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's more mice and rats, but we still say, right. it's still a colloquial expression, you know.
Yeah, I think it means one to be tested on. So, I mean, I have a lot of friends and relatives who take various sort of antidepressive drugs and things like that. I probably should be taking a lot of those drugs. And the way they figure out what's best for you is they have a whole bunch of them. And yeah. physicians have admitted this. They give you one that is the best indication for your age and body type and things like that. And they hope it works. And if it doesn't work, then they try another one.
Right.
They are using you effectively as a human guinea pig.
Right.
You're trying to make that a little more directed?
Well, you know, before you risk human health with a new drug, you want to have some idea that it will work and maybe not have serious side effects right. and things like that. So, you know, by being able to record in the brain while the drug is administered, mm-hmm. we can see it's not affecting the cell like we thought it would, or it's having this deleterious effect elsewhere or something like that. So pharmaceutical companies, you know, it takes about $1 billion to bring a drug to market today. And a lot of that effort is in clinical trials. And so to be able to do animal studies up front in a rapid way could really improve that, you know, shorten the pipeline and reduce the cost.
So you mentioned animal models before, and of course animal models are used because it's sometimes more convenient and easy to do rather than getting humans involved in that. And particularly with institute review board protocols on human subjects research now, we're very limited in what we can do with humans as opposed to, say, 40, 50 years ago. The laws were very different. But I'm curious, different animals make better models for humans for different organ systems. What's the best animal model for the human brain? Or do they even know?
Yeah, this is a sensitive subject, so I want to be mindful of our listeners out there. Okay. But you know, the most important thing is that we're trying to improve human life, and you know, we try to minimize as much as possible the pain to these animals, and everything we do is reviewed by an animal.
Right, has to be here at Georgia Tech.
Right, right. So there's a board that reviews everything and makes sure, you know, you're not causing unnecessary harm and things like that. Mm-hmm. You're only using as few animals as necessary, mm-hmm. and so forth. So the mouse is the most popular model today. Mm-hmm. The second most popular model is the primate, the monkey,
right,
brain.
Because you would think in terms of higher brain function, it'd be similar to us.
Right, yeah. Right. Of course, there are many people working on other animals.
Do you have any, you know, sort of simpler models that you use when you're testing, like, do you use worms or
tissue? Yeah, worms are, there's a particular type of worm that's very popular, C. elegans, and rats are popular as well. But I think what makes mice so popular is that there's a revolution going on right now with a new kinds of tool for the brain that uses light to turn the brain on and off. Mm-hmm. This tool is called optogenetics. Mm-hmm. It's revolutionized neuroscience in the past decade. And if there's not a Nobel Prize for it this week, there'll probably be one next year. And basically, mice can now be bred to have brains that can be turned on and off with light. So you can go to a catalog.
Light, right?
You can just go into a catalog and buy them.
Wow. So then what makes the mice model so useful is that you can breed in these constant lines that have specific properties.
That's
you can
right.
Knock so just out like, a particular gene
exactly.
and things like
just
that.
Just like you might have a brown mouse or a white mouse, you can have a mouse whose brain can be turned on and off with light.
So how do you turn these things on and off with light?
So you insert optical fibers into the brain.
Okay, so you've actually got an optical fiber in there.
The mouse runs around and then you can turn the light on and it will do something that you have programmed it to do.
Oh, so you can activate specific brain function via an optical fiber. And an optic fiber, these things are as thin as a human hair, very small, not particularly invasive.
Right.
It's not like
drill a
bolt.
Tiny hole in the skull, insert the fiber, glue it in place.
Right. And I know a lot of our listeners are thinking, drill a tiny hole? Actually, the brain doesn't have any... Right. Pain sensors in it, does it?
So,
is that true of the mice
as well?
The
brain does not have pain sensors.
Right.
The skull does.
Right.
So
right.
It is painful.
But you can anesthetize that? Or?
So in the U.S. every year, there are about 500,000 craniotomies on humans to relieve brain pressure from swelling from an injury or things like that. So it's a relatively routine procedure.
Yeah.
There are 100,000 people walking around today with deep brain stimulators implanted in their brain that were inserted through a hole in their head.
And will your research, so deep brain stimulation, there are students in my startup living learning community that are talking about the use of this to do everything from regulate sleep to depression, all these sorts of things. But right now, they're a little bit of an art. They know that if they stimulate this way in this section of the brain, they'll get these general effects. Will your research try to make that very focused on a much smaller area of neurons so you can do something more specific?
Yeah, that's the hope. You know, compared to the complexity of, say, a computer with its tiny circuit boards, the technology today for stimulating the brain is like electrical circuits of the 1800s.
Yeah.
And not to say it's not a miracle and it's wonderful for those 100,000 people, but it's very primitive. Basically, there are four electrodes which are placed into a region of the brain called the thalamus, about 5 inches down. Okay, so in the center of the brain. And there's a kind of pacemaker type thing that's put into the chest, which can turn those electrical wires on and off. Mm-hmm. And this is mainly
used
for Parkinson's, Parkinson's tremors.
Okay, so tremor-based diseases.
Yeah, so maybe 50 years ago, neurosurgeons discovered that if you removed the thalamus of the brain, if you just went in and scooped it out with a spoon,
right.
Parkinson's patients would stop having tremors.
But the thalamus, very important to the endocrine system, right?
Right. So there'd be lots of other problems.
So temporary stimulation
exactly.
has a similar effect.
So stimulation can sort of modulate that effect and turn it on and off when you need it and so on.
So that kind of basically characterizes a lot of how we describe the brain now. Many, many years ago, 30s and 40s, we did a lot of electroshock therapy. Now we call it electroconvulsive therapy. And it's actually coming back because even though we don't know why some of these electrical stimuli work, they do work in some cases.
Oh, yeah.
So it seems very empirical. This does this, this does that. And that sounds like the kind of thing you're trying to get it focused down to the cellular level.
Yeah. Have you heard of a frontal lobotomy?
Yes, I have.
So this was a popular procedure.
And I believe that, too, got the Nobel Prize, lo, these many years ago.
So the idea is you take an ice pick. And you place it just above the eyeball, and then you take a mallet and you punch it through the back of the orbital socket.
So it gets
there.
To the frontal lobe.
Right. And then there was a specific procedure once you were in to
swirl it around. And scramble that part of the
left and right, up and down, you know, a certain number of times and so forth. Yeah. And then the patient who was previously... you know, maybe had some hyperactive disorder or was sort of, you know, couldn't be consoled or whatever, would be much more sedated.
But the side effects had some problems.
This was actually an outpatient procedure.
And I didn't realize it was an outpatient procedure.
You'd go home with some mild bruising around the eye.
Yeah.
And in a couple of days, good as new, except for the scrambled egg front part of your brain.
Right. Which turned out to have very important function, and then you realize later you had serious problems with other higher cognitive functions.
Like planning the next day's activities.
Yes, exactly.
Not possible.
all right, so let me actually remind some of our listeners. We've actually had a couple calls already. We're trying to get people to tweet. Why can't we get people to tweet? Does this mean only old people are listening to the show? But if you do have a question or call and you're listening live, today's October 7th, 2015, by all means, give us a call at the studio if you've got a question or a comment for Craig at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. Or if you have joined the 21st century, you can tweet us at Blackbox WREK, right?
Yes.
Okay, black box. But we're not getting any tweets. What's the deal? My hypothesis is only old people are listening to the show.
Maybe people are listening in their car and they don't.
That is true. A lot of people are. So if you're driving, do not tweet. actually, one of our callers mentioned that last week. So that's perfectly fine. But if you are at your computer, send us a tweet or give us a call. So I see the value of this thing. It's going to take this sort of empirical view of how we treat the brain, focus it down to the neuron level. And what's the name of this NIH program? Isn't it called like the Brain Program or
right? So about a year and a half ago now, President Obama decided to personally champion a new research direction from the federal government, and they decided to call it the Brain Initiative. And the idea is that we want to bring together a large group of the nation's scientists and engineers to try to develop tools that can measure brain activity in the living body.
Mm-hmm.
Neuroscientists have been stuck because these tools do not exist today.
Right.
To measure this stuff at this scale, at this speed, at this number of cells and so forth. And so it's a very exciting time for engineers because the neuroscientists are standing there with open arms saying, please help us. And it's kind of this gold rush right now. We're running in and we're saying, we can build stuff. What do you need us to build? And then when you build it, they'll say, I'll try it. That's awesome. Let me try that and see what I can measure. And we'll work together and try to solve some science problem together. So it's been an awesome adventure. And, you know, my lab is really fully committed to this. And all the students I've hired and who have expertise in neuroscience and biomedical engineering, they're very passionate about, you know, helping society and trying to make some fundamental improvement in our understanding of the brain.
So how many of these cells can you monitor at one time? I mean, you're still just looking at a few. Is your goal to get it more?
Yeah, so it depends on what type of recording you're doing. Let's take one example. So there's a type of recording called extracellular recording, which means you lower these metal wires down, and they're sort of placed in the brain nearby cells, and you sort of try to hear what's going on locally. Mm-hmm. The maximum number right now is a couple hundred.
Okay.
A couple hundred cells. And that has still been very useful in trying to understand how the brain works.
Yeah.
But the brain, as I mentioned, has billions of neurons. So we're really at the very, very early stages.
Mm-hmm.
And those can't record for very long. When you load them, when you place them into the brain, they do damage. As you can imagine, inserting mm-hmm. a wire into your brain does not come without consequences. And so there could be swelling, inflammation, bleeding. And so you can only record for maybe a few hours or a few days. And then the tissue is...
But that's still a fair amount of time.
It is, but say you wanted to walk around with one of these implants, mm-hmm. you know, it wouldn't work for you.
Okay, so it's a measurement device. It's working okay
yeah.
for the few hour, few day kind of thing.
Right.
But eventually we'll have to figure out another right. way to...
Like say, for example, epilepsy. Let's take epilepsy mm-hmm. as another example of a disease of the brain. So there are some people who have epilepsy with such severity that they have hundreds of seizures per day. And... they do not respond well to drugs to treat them. And so doctors make the difficult decision that they want to remove part of the patient's brain mm-hmm. that's triggering these electrical storms, these lightning storms in the brain. They want to remove it altogether. So how do you figure out what part of the brain to remove? So what they do is they remove an entire half of the patient's skull. And you have to lay there very carefully for a week with a blanket of electrodes on the surface of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
They place a flexible array of electrodes directly onto the brain and try to keep you from getting any infections and whatnot.
Because that's going to be tough.
Yeah.
With your brain exposed.
And you'll have seizures, of course, like you always
right,
do.
Right.
And they can measure where it's coming from and then go in and scoop it out.
Okay.
So... that's not invasive. It's just on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
It's called an ECOG array. And that's another type of recording electrode that has, you know, hundreds. But it's just for the surface. So if you have other problems deep in the brain, there's no way to record those.
Okay. So you're basically going one step right. beyond an EEG, right? Which
right.
would just be surface electrodes.
Right.
And you only get the surface remnant of the electric field go to the surface of the
right.
brain. And then are there things that look below that if it's a deep brain issue?
So it's very difficult to record with a high resolution deep in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
The metal wires can go in a few millimeters maybe.
Okay.
Of course, you can put recording electrodes deep in there, but if you put more than a few, it becomes problematic.
Mm-hmm. So swelling, edema,
yeah.
that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
What about robots? I was promised robots today.
Okay.
Yeah.
So...
are these devices sort of robotic in nature? That's the impression
I get. Neuroscience is something of an art form, really. The techniques that people use that I'm describing about placing things in the brain, they're, for the most part, manual techniques. So you train for years to have the physical dexterity to slide a tiny... metal wire into the brain into just the right place. And what we have been developing in my lab is robotic tools that will do that automatically. So you can place the brain into the robot's
claw.
Common theme here, the claw.
And then the robot will orient itself and say, okay, I know where the brain is. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to go. And then you say, okay, go ahead, robot. And then it will lower these electrodes much more rapidly and much more accurately. What?
Define lower. Have we removed the cranium, or is this going right through the cranium of a mouse or whatever it is?
The skull is a barrier to entry.
The skull is a barrier.
And he was very sensitive before about the amp. Now he's like, well, the electrodes go in. That's all I'm going to say.
You know, using a robotic tools to place electrodes in the brain, we can make dozens of recordings in one day as opposed to one if we're lucky.
Okay.
And so for example, in Seattle, there's a nonprofit institution called the Allen Institute for Brain Science, and they have spent the past 4 months doing this, recording brain activity in individual cells. And they just published their data set. This was all done in brain slices, not in living brains, but mm-hmm. the point is the same. They did about 250 cells in 4 months with a team of four working full time. Mm-hmm. Four people, 4 months, 250 cells. So that's just not enough. Not even
right.
close.
No. Right.
Not when you've got
to
how
sample
many
86 billion.
Right. So it's still a huge insight. No one ever right. recorded that many yeah. before. But we need robotic tools to be able to record and then sort of step and scan over large areas.
Uh-huh. Oh, so this will eventually be kind of like a confocal microscope of electrodes.
Yeah. Imagine being able to form a picture, or let's say you wanted to do neurosurgery. Let's say I had a part of my brain that was diseased and I wanted to go and cut it out with surgical precision, cell by mm-hmm. cell. Mm-hmm. So I could go in with a robot mm-hmm. and I could zap the cells that were bad mm-hmm. and then retract much more precisely than a person controlling mm-hmm. the scalpel.
So I still don't understand, how do you get through the cranium? Is that part of the robot experience?
So,
because a human would have to do that too, right?
So to go through the skull, the most common method is to perform a technique called a craniotomy, mm-hmm. which is basically to drill a small hole.
Okay.
And we use a dental drill. It's a very high speed dental mm-hmm. drill, 100,000 RPMs, and you drill a tiny burr hole.
Okay.
Just small enough to be able to get the electrical wires in there.
So the robot drills the hole, moves the wires, places them in the correct right. position, but does it right. faster with greater precision.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's a big, that's right. a plus.
That's right.
What are the challenges in getting robots to do that, though?
Well, you know,
because we would have done that years ago. Because, right, humans, we're not dependent. I mean,
right.
you know.
Well, so humans may not have the most careful hands, and right. and humans need coffee breaks and bathroom breaks. But one thing humans do well is that we can adapt to unusual situations. Mm-hmm. So having a robot that can respond if it misses a cell, or, you know, loses the cell or whatever, it with the same clever, you know, awareness of what's happening is, mm-hmm. is very difficult.
Okay. So if nothing goes wrong, the robots will do, you know, brain after brain, cell after cell.
That's right.
Place them accurately.
That's
but
right.
every once in a while.
Ideally, you could put the robot with the brain in the closet uh-huh. and come back the next day. And it would
have
done
the sample data.
The work of yeah. a year of a regular person.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Are there parts of the cortex that are less important, that we know are less important? Like, where are you going to drill these holes? Like, are there parts of the yeah. skull where you don't want to drill a hole?
Or is this something we're still figuring out?
Where is the memory of your grandmother stored?
Yeah. I don't want that to
but,
be gone.
You know, the memory of, say, certain obnoxious in-laws... drill there. That's okay.
That's the in-law portion is a common entry point.
I'm writing that down. So it sounds like this is something that's variable, right? Everything right. is in theory valuable.
The cortex is a very stereotype, so it has this kind of pattern to it. It's like a quilt. And it's got these sort of patches that do things, but the it's all a fabric. It's all the same threads.
Right.
So, you know, whether, you know, maybe you could say, well, this, you know, we can go in here because we don't see any observable effect, but nobody really right. knows.
So precision robots to sample this cell level data.
That's right.
Clearly the advantage. We can see that. Where's it going? Where are the first things you're going to apply this thing to? or people would like to apply it to?
I think drug companies are a major opportunity here that we can revolutionize the testing and development of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
We started a company a couple years ago called Neuromatic Devices that sells this robot. And there are already dozens of neuroscience institutions that have purchased it. So that's exciting, you know, to see that neuroscience labs that really just want to get their science done using whatever tools are available have purchased this robot and set it up in their lab so they can use it to answer their own science questions. So so those are the two big applications so far, is basic mm-hmm. neuroscience in neuroscience labs like Georgia Tech and other universities, mm-hmm. and drug companies.
Wow. So we've reached the portion of the program we like to call What Have We Learned?
Ah.
I've learned a lot. So first of all, that the brain is the ultimate frontier, to borrow from Star Trek, right? That, you know, we have a much better understanding of mechanically and chemically how things work with other organs. The brain is very difficult. There are things we don't understand about the brain and things we only understand empirically. And I think what's needed, what is being pushed by the brain initiative, by the NIH through the president, is to come up with tools to sample the brain at a higher precision, right? Not just functional MRI to look at, you know, areas that light up and areas that light up and correlate with other things, but in fact, cell by cell.
Right.
So to sample one cell, sample many cells, and look at exactly what the nature, the frequency, the voltage of these electrical signals are. Once we do that, we can look at diseases that might be related to this.
And maybe we can figure out how consciousness arises.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that would be the ultimate thing.
Wouldn't that be crazy?
Yeah, that would be crazy. And then once we understand those signals, we could do very straightforward things like make prosthetics that via an arm or a hand could repeat the pattern of the signals. So clearly the key is understanding or producing a tool that will help us understand this cell-by-cell view. We learned that figuring out the 86 billion neurons in the brain, similar to counting jelly beans at the county fair.
Mm-hmm. And just as tasty.
Right, just as So I've had cow brains, never human brains. Is that tasty? Do people do that? No? Is that something on your dinner plate? On a
I'd rather not comment. Okay.
It's not going to comment because he's trying to be simple. He's trying to be sensitive. And probably the biggest difficulty is the fact that these cells are so difficult. So they use sort of a modern adapted version of something adopted 30 years ago called patch clamping that gets basically a sensor, a tube, a wire so close to the membrane of this thing. And the key, I think, is obviously getting it nudged exactly in there. Something that might be difficult for humans that may not have the most precise hands. So the answer, and this is what's being developed out of Craig's lab, is a robotic tool that will do that very thing. Typically used on mouse models, because mouse models are very convenient because of this ability to use, optogenetics to turn on or off via optical signals in the brain. To do that sort of thing. And hopefully this will be something that will help us with the deeper part of the brain as opposed to this sampling on the surface of it. And may address everything from, as you pointed out before, the nature of cognition to diseases like epilepsy to other neurotremor diseases like this. And there are mm-hmm. a lot of them, right? And hopefully help us understand this beyond the point where we simply go in, sense what's causing the problem, and scoop it out. I think we agree, scooping out parts of the brain, kind of like the equivalent of leeches a few centuries ago. You know, it does get the job done, but I'm sure there are side effects with, as Jennifer pointed out, either you're losing your memory of grandma, or if it's in-laws, maybe nobody really cares about that sort of thing. as far as where this thing is going to go, and you make a very good point that it may be the first application of this device, which is now produced by Neuromatic Devices, a company that spun off of this, is a better way to test drugs. And mm-hmm. when I think about friends and family that are on drugs for depression or drugs for brain illnesses, they literally do use humans as guinea pigs. They give it to you, they change the dosage, they mess with the dosage, and they hope that one works over the other. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you could look at the pattern of electrical signals at the cellular level via these tools and see what is the response we want that drug to do, this is something you could test much more quickly and much more accurately. And hopefully that will be the future of drug testing. I think that's cool. Wow. And we're not worried about robots getting into your brain and taking over the world or anything like that. It's always the standard robot.
They're all friendly for now.
They're all friendly robots. Did we leave anything out? Anything you need to add? That and sign up for the Inventure Prize competition, which is which is now taking students. That'll be in the spring. So, Craig, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you've got a question or a comment and you're one of our listeners, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our theme music, which you did not hear tonight, but had you heard it, was composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.